Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
As we always do on a Monday, we have someone to look over some of the stories from the weekend and at other times. Today, it's the writer and activist Sandrine Dahiro. Good afternoon, Sandrine.
Hi, how are you?
Not too bad. Now, apart from being a writer and an activist, you also teach. You're doing a PhD. Your day is fairly full by the sounds of it. One of the things you're looking at for your PhD is Afrofuturism. What is that?
Yeah, so with Afrofuturism, it just reimagines what it would be like for Africans to kind of imagine a new future which doesn't fit into what way we see it here in the West. So an example of Afrofuturism, I don't know if you've seen the movie Black Panther.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so like that would be a feature of it, where again, like you saw in Wakanda, like it was this new world where, like, when you're describing Africa, it wasn't this helpless state or like victimization. It was like this place of innovation and creativity. So that's what Afrofuturism looks like.
Right. Okay. And so would it tend to be kind of in within books? It would be science fiction, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so it would be in science fiction, but with my research, I look at it through the lens of climate change. So I look at how, like, when we're talking about climate change and just like the global crisis, African perspectives are still left out because the African continent is still seen as this place that, like, has so many issues that, like, climate change is just another one to add on to. But when you look at it through an Afrofuturist lens, you see how Africans for decades have actually been engaging with climate change issues, but like they've been doing it in their own unique way. So like that's what my research is on.
Yeah, I imagine though that if you project into the future for Africa in relation to climate change, it wouldn't be necessarily a good picture.
Yeah, no, and like with that, then I look at it through like an apocalyptic doomsday scenario that we're all kind of facing now in regards to like what way is the future? And again, like what ways are climate change affecting Africans in a different way than it's affecting us here in the West? And again, like what does that future look like? So like I still haven't figured it out that much. I'm only going into my third year now. So I have some understanding of it, but like I still have a lot to look at. But Afrofuturism helps in that way because it's a completely, like, as you say, like a science fiction utopian world, so that's the way I kind of engage with that.
Right. Okay. Now, speaking of apocalyptic futures, one of the stories Sandrine has chosen is the comments from Leo Varadkar that we shouldn't lose heart because the COVID patient numbers have dropped below 500 for the first time since October. Would you be optimistic, Sandrine, about all of this?
Yeah. So with that one, like I understand the frustration, and I think like the fact that we've been with COVID for close to 2 years now, it's really, really easy to lose hope in that. Like I know myself, like I've kind of had to like turn off, like just watching, kind of keeping up to date in regards to COVID numbers, because it does become very overwhelming. But I understand like why like politicians and like world leaders kind of have to keep saying this word of hope, because that's the only thing that we really have, you know, like we really do need to try to be as hopeful as we can and kind of try to see that light at the end of the tunnel, which it becomes really hard, especially now coming up to Christmas. Do you know, like I think everyone is worrying about that, like are you going to be able to see family and friends, and like what these new restrictions mean, and again, like how can you keep hope like when you've been listening to kind of this same mantra for like the last 2 years,
especially if you work in any of the nighttime industries. Their hope was just dashed at the weekend.
Yeah, no, and I saw that. And again, it's one of those, because I remember there was like that debate in regards to like the PUP and like the fact that whether people or not were going back. And with these jobs, especially like in the nightclub industry, the bars and everything, like they're student wise. And like I'm teaching first to fourth years in UL, and like I can see that, like I can see the impact that that has. Like maybe sometimes like someone's workplace is the only place that they have to socialize. And I think the fact that like with nightclubs and like even theatres and everything, like they were kind of the last things to open back in October, and now straight away they've been told like that's kind of gone again. So I can understand like where it's really hard to kind of keep that faith when like there is no clear message there in that regards, because you're kind of in and out of the pandemic payment and in and out of uncertainty, especially like when maybe this Christmas period like is the time that people will kind of go out more and stuff like that. So maybe that's when someone would get more hours. So like that's not really been taken into account.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I mean, and a lot of people who had gigs organised now have to figure out if they go ahead, how you just split the audience in half, and how do you make that decision? It seems as if increasing amounts of people are just cancelling them altogether, because you can't really. Also, a story that Sandrine picked out was the comments by the Taoiseach saying that unvaccinated people are jeopardising themselves and others. Are we kind of blaming unvaccinated? Are we kind of, you know, because we're all angry and cranky and frustrated, and maybe are we disproportionately blaming unvaccinated people for all of this?
I think we're using them as a scapegoat. I think that everyone is so frustrated in the sense of I kind of saw like that scapegoat kind of come in once we like the booster shots were announced, and people were still like, well, like I've been vaccinated and following the guidelines, and you know, the cases are still high. And I think we're still, since COVID is affecting everyone, like there's no, like you can't be like immune to this, that it's very easy that like when people are very fearful and there's no clear guidelines or anything like that, to just kind of blame whoever it is. Because in the summer it was like we're blaming youth, then we were blaming different minority communities. So like there's always someone that we're blaming like every now and then, like once there's a spike. And again, like we're going to see that, like that blame is going to come up again, like when it comes to Christmas, and it'll be like, oh, it's the people which are traveling to go home, or it's the people that are meeting up. So like I think in society, like we're always going to find someone to use as a scapegoat, as opposed to kind of like really looking at like, oh yeah, what is the issue and why are cases still so high with stuff like that. But again, it's just inevitable that we're going to find people to blame, and in this situation then it is people that are unvaccinated.
Yeah, but at the same token, people who are unvaccinated would say they're being discriminated against because they don't have a vaccine passport, and it creates a two-tier society where people with the passport can do things, people without it can't.
Yeah, no, I've seen that. I think recently, wasn't it like in the cinema where they announced that you had to have a COVID passport. And I saw like, because I'm from Carlow, and the IMC in Carlow, like they, you know, like they kind of did a release and they were like, oh, we apologize for the inconvenience. So like I thought that was nice to kind of like acknowledge that not everyone is vaccinated. And the fact that like these rules are coming into place, there is going to like cause like a further division and a further tension there between people which are vaccinated versus unvaccinated, where it's kind of like, oh well, like in order to, I don't know, like see the movies or like interact with other people, then you have no choice but to be vaccinated. But again, that's people's just personal choice. But I can see the tension there when it comes to the people that are vaccinated versus not. Especially just like in places like the cinema or like just restaurants and everything like that, especially when, again, like when the cases are rising, because they're just the first groups that people blame.
Yeah. So do you think it's unfair, the blame the same as the unvaccinated?
I just think like it's people's personal choice. Do you know, like I know people which are not vaccinated, and like for them, like that's their own personal choice. But like I'm not going to project onto them like what I think. But for me, it's like I got vaccinated because it's, you just never know who you're going to interact with, and why would you risk that for anyone else? But again, like people are very strong minded with these with the vaccination. They're looking at it more from like a political, as opposed to like we're all suffering through this together, like why not just everyone be vaccinated in that regards, that it's going to be helping. Like if you don't believe in the vaccine, or if you don't believe in it, like someone else is going to benefit from you being vaccinated. But again, like that's just my own personal choice, and I can't, like for me it's like I won't like try to convert people into being vaccinated, because they have their own choices. But for me, like I just understood like why it was just a no-brainer to get vaccinated.
Yeah, indeed. But do you think it's fair, though, to have a system where you have to have a pass that you have been vaccinated, and that allows you access to places or not, if you're not?
Yeah, I think I understand why it's in place, because, again, it's the only way that is going to kind of provide this safety net for people which are vaccinated, to know that, OK, at least we've done our part. And I think that's where like the tension is, because it's like, Like, you know, like, I'm double vaccinated. I wear my mask everywhere, like, even when I'm teaching, everything like that. And I think it does become very tiring then, like, if you are teaching people which are not vaccinated, because it's like, but like, I'm here trying, and like, you are risking your life, like, every time you're leaving your house if you're not vaccinated, because you don't know the places you're going into. And like, maybe you might catch COVID and it's a mild symptom for you, but for someone else. And I think just being aware of like the power that you have, that again, you can pass that on to someone. And if you're not fully vaccinated, like, that's the choice you're willingly making. I don't know. It just goes into like just morality there, and like, what's your personal belief. But I understand why governments and like all these places like do require for you to be vaccinated, because again, it's not about you, it's just the safety of the people which are already in those establishment.
Now, another thing that a campaign that you took part in is the 100 Voices. Tell us what that was, Sandrine.
Yeah, so with this one, it was Hot Press released a statement where they were looking for people from different marginalized communities to talk about racism. But they did it in a very particular and like and clever and heartwarming way, where they rang us up, or like, you had the option of writing something, or you could just do a phone interview. And it was, you could talk about anything. So like, again, it wasn't this narrative of, oh, like, so you've experienced racism in Ireland and Ireland is racist. It was like, no, like, what do you think about racism? And again, it's like, what have you done in your lived experiences that either has educated other people, or you're thinking about educating other people? So for me, like, when I was talking with Hot Press, like, I looked at it in the opportunity to just show like how there's so many new, like, since the conversation started like last year in regards to BLM, like, how there's a need to look at how racism in Ireland isn't black and white, because you still have communities like the traveller community, people in direct provision who are discriminated against. So like, it can't be a black and white thing. But then it's like, what are we doing? And for me myself, like, I'm engaging in the cultural and like artistic space, where I'm just trying to centralize and provide, give safe spaces for people who look like me to tell their own stories, like, in whichever capacity that they can.
Did they have any difficulty finding 100 people to relate instances of racism?
No, like, because the way they did it, it was they provide, like, they sent emails out to like different community members, and it was that sense of like, if you're not comfortable telling your story, please pass it on. So everyone was happy to, like, if they didn't want to tell their story, to pass it on, because like, if you're a marginalized community in Ireland, like, you know someone who's going through the same thing. So like, if at that day you don't want to talk about it, there's hundreds of people that you can pass the email to. So they did a great job in that regards, like, where they left that open-ended, where if you didn't want to take part, you could just recommend someone else.
Yeah. No, but when you've experienced it, can it be sometimes subtle, in the sense that it's only afterwards you go, oh my God, that's what was going on there?
Yeah, and I think like that's where, like, I have a few friends which are not from Ireland, and like, when they met me, they were like, I didn't even know black people existed in Ireland, because like, if you Google Ireland, like, you know, black people just don't come up. And I think then, like, we don't have police brutality here. Like, yes, there's still tension between black community and the police, but like, again, it isn't something that like is ingrained as it is in America or like in the UK. So like, in Ireland, it's like, whenever I talk about racism, it's one of those things where like, it's so subtle that even members within the black community, it's like, if you wouldn't realize something is racist until someone tells you their story, and you're like, wait, that happened to me, and I didn't even realize that. And I started reflecting on that last year when myself and my friend Catherine Osokoye did a documentary called On Silencing Black Voices, and we asked people to think, to recall like a minute of a racist incident that happened to them. And when me and Kathy were listening back to like putting it all together, I was like, all those, like, we had like around 20 people, so the documentary was around 25 minutes, and all those 20 minutes, there are things that happened to me, but I never considered them racism, because I think I'd just become like immune to it, and I like, just the traumatic experience of it just had me kind of like accept it. That it wasn't until I was listening to someone else talking about how hard it was for them that I was like, oh yeah, like, that was racist. But like, again, I just normalized it for myself.
Could you give us an example?
Yeah, so like with a lot of the time, it's like when I usually wear my afro hair a lot of the times. And so like when I'd go on a night out or anything like that, like people would pull at it and everything like that. And for me, again, like I just brush it aside. But again, that's like a form of like fetishization and kind of like making me feel like I'm in a petting zoo, because again, it's like someone just feeling the claim of having to hold your hair. And so in the documentary, there's another girl who talked about like how when she wears her hair, her afro hair, she's always really scared that like when she goes in a night out, someone is going to pull at her hair, like physically like pull at her hair, because they're trying to figure out whether or not that's a weave, do you know? And like that's such like a dehumanizing experience. And it wasn't until I heard that I was like, oh my God, like I didn't experience, I never thought that like that's what they were trying to do when they were touching my hair. Because there's a sense of like, oh, you can be curious about someone's hair, but you don't go up and touch it, like unless like someone, one of my best friends is like a hairdresser, so like I always understand like if I do different hairstyles, she'll look at it and I'll like be like, yeah, you can touch it, and she'll, because she wants to try a different hairstyle. But like when it's a random stranger on a night out who's just trying to humiliate you, and again like just try to like, oh, is the hair real or not? Like, so trying to feed into these stereotypes, and people around me like don't see that as something wrong, because again, it's if I laugh it off, like then it's like, oh, they laugh it off as well. So like that's where with the documentary we really wanted to show like how like these racist jokes and everything like that, which have been accepted for so long, like we really need to like dismantle them. But again, like it took me up until like last year when we did the documentary to understand like those little and nuanced ways like that I've gone through that I didn't consider racist until someone else told me their story.
Sandrine, we do have to take a break, but please stay with us. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. We'll chat more with Sandrine De Hero after this. 53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cent. We are still talking with the writer and activist Sandrine De Hero. Sandrine, when you were talking about the 100 voices thing, and particularly about you go out, and it seemed to be a common experience, particularly among women, that their hair would get touched. Can I read a text out from someone who says, "Bald men get their heads slapped and touched on nights out. I don't. Pale white people and redheads get touched when in Asia or Africa. Is it racism? Is everyone racist?"
You see, I think like that's always like the common thing, like when a black person kind of talks about their experience of racism in Ireland, like where there's always, it's very quick to just again like try to find a comparison or try to just say that like, oh, do you know, like everyone is racist. It's not in that regards. Like I'm not saying that everyone in Ireland is racist, because like that's ridiculous. I mean like just a small minority, like where like that's just one instance that I can recall. Like I have hundreds, and like that's why it's like called the 100 voices in that regards, where it's these stories like where when like I know that it's racist when someone touches my hair without me saying, asking for permission. And again, like if you read Emma Dabiri's Don't Touch My Hair, like she talks about like how again like hair can be political, and it's just that claim of viewing someone as inferior or like kind of placing them in that subcategory, like where you just feel like an ownership to them. It's not a sense of like, oh, I admire your hair or anything like that. It's just to kind of remind you of how you are an other, do you know? And like other experiences, it's like when if I'm talking about like, oh, I'm black and Irish, and it's like, no, because black people can't be Irish, do you know? Like that's racist, because again, like Irishness isn't white, like it's changing. And like the fact that like Ireland is so diverse and there's different multiple generations of migrants and minorities, everything like that in Ireland, like it's just, you just can't go around now and just say that for every black, Asian, Indian person that like again you meet and they tell you that they're Indian and Irish or black and Irish, and you just claim that they can't be just because of their skin color, like that is racist. And I think like that's where again people just see it as, I don't know, like in Ireland, the fact that we were colonized and we have this really strong understanding of what it means to be Irish, that anyone that doesn't share that colonial past or colonial history then is kind of excluded from that. And that's why we still have racism in Ireland, and that's why it's still such like a hot topic, where again people are very quick to just either say like, well, do you know, like we were colonized as well, or again like with that example of like being bald, like they're not the same thing. And it's like in order for us to move forward, it's just having to just understand, like, that when a black person tells you something is racist, like, it's just a very dismissive thing, trying to compare and contrast with different experiences that have happened. Because again, like, racism is power. And when, like, and when someone, as I say, when someone touches my hair or like says that I can't be Irish, like, they're taking that power away from me. So, like, that feeling isn't something that I would ever wish on anyone. And so, like, that's just, like, that'll be, like, my response back to that.
Yeah. And, well, when you were a child, I think you were 10, I think, when your family first moved to Carlow.
Yeah, so my dad lived in Ireland before, so he would have moved, I think, in 2000. So, and then we moved in 2006. So, yeah, like, when, yeah, I was 10 when I moved to Carlow.
Yeah, and so did you at the start, at least, did you feel kind of like you were from two different places almost?
Yeah, because it was one of those things, like, even till now, like, I'm 26 now, and I think I still try to understand, like, what it means to be, like, both Rundese and Irish. So, like, I made it in the sense, like, when we moved to Ireland, like, we would have lived in Kenya before. So in Kenya, like, you speak English. So I would have been fluent in English when we moved to Ireland. So, like, the language barrier there, like, the fact that I was able to speak English, it really did help in making friends at a quicker rate than other migrants that come into Ireland, and, like, there's that language barrier. But I found it hard in regards to, like, I would still speak Swahili when I was at home and then speak English when I was in school. So, like, trying to navigate the two. And a lot of the times, even though there was other black community in Carlow, like, it wasn't, again, like, there wasn't a huge presence of it. So, like, it was just trying to navigate being young and trying to, like, fit in. And, you know, like, I remember, like, always straightening my hair because I hated my afro hair, because, again, like, I stood out for that. Or, you know, like, just even just the way I spoke, I always made really sure that I was very articulate, because then I didn't want to have an accent for someone to kind of, like, exclude me more. But again, like, even with those efforts, like, the fact that I was black, like, my skin color, like, it's still, like, that's where the racism came from. Like, where it didn't matter if I spoke English, anything like that. And even when we were in Ireland for, like, the long time, like, when I got my Irish passport, I was very, like, I was very naive in thinking that, like, when I was younger, that it was like, oh, okay, like, once I have my Irish passport, I'm, like, an Irish citizen, then, like, no one is going to question that. But they still do, because, again, it's, like, the black skin, like, there, it's something that people just can't accept, that that can be Irish as well.
Mm. Has it got easier?
It's not really. Like, it's gotten easier in regards to, like, I understand who I am, and I understand, like, I'm Irish. So, like, if someone trolls or anything like that, if they're like to question that, like, I just don't engage with that. So, like, it's gotten easier in regards to, like, just myself with my understanding. But, like, even now, as a researcher, like, I write about, again, like, how Irishness is changing and all these faceted, like, discussions. But even then, like, I always make sure, like, if I'm being introduced, like, if I'm doing a talk like this, like, I don't like being like, oh yeah, like, sending, like, the black scholar or anything like that, because I'm like, there's so much more to me than being black in Ireland, you know. So, and it's like, you can see that, like, with the work that I do with the activism, like, it isn't just to do with racism, it's just in regards to inclusion and creating these safe spaces for people that look like me, but then also other minority voices, where, like, they can write and produce art that, again, like, it's leading into, like, feeding into, like, a cultural richness that Ireland, like, needs and wants in that regard. So, like, it's gotten easier in that regards that I just know who I am, so it's easier to navigate it, but, like, people still question it, you know.
Sandrine, thanks a million for speaking with us today. That was the writer and activist Sandrine DeHiro. We're going to
Moncrief on News Talk,
brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.